Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how abortion opponents are reshaping their tactics in a post-Roe world and tracing the history of the first Chinese immigrants in Tucson. But first, a bipartisan coalition of Arizona's congressional delegation has introduced legislation aimed at addressing a long-running water issue for some of Arizona's biggest tribes. It's called the Northeastern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement Act of 2024, and it ratifies an historic agreement to secure water rights for the Navajo Nation, the Hopi Tribe, and the San Juan Southern Paiute Tribe. That means, supporters say, certainty and stability for the tribes going forward, as well as a path for future growth. Shandine Silversmith is covering the story for the Arizona Mirror, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Shandine.
Good morning.
So begin with some of the details of this plan for us. I know this settles the tribe's claims to the main stem of the Colorado River, but it provides them with infrastructure funding for future projects as well, right?
Yes, it does. So the three tribes would be guaranteed access to over 56,000 acre feet of the Colorado River stem, but also groundwater rights and protection. So it would give them access to the aquifers that are surrounding their indigenous communities, as well as watersheds within their communities. But one of the things that is really unique about this water settlement is it also helps them acquire funding to maintain the water development and water infrastructure needed to support their communities.
Right, going forward. So I know this has been a long time coming. The negotiations for this have been going on for decades. Tell us some of the history that's led us to this point.
So it's actually really interesting because the Colorado River Compact was divided the Colorado River in 1922, but tribes were left out of that discussion. So over decades, not only the Navajo Nation and the Hopi Tribe or the San Juan Paiute Tribe, but all tribes within Arizona have been negotiating their water rights. Right. And a lot of them have come to settlements with the federal government and the state of Arizona. But the Navajo Nation, the Hopi Tribe, and the San Juan Southern Paiute Tribe are some of the last tribes to kind of bring this type of settlement to Congress to be able to gain access to their water settlement rights. So this has, like you said, has been decades of negotiation between all of these entities involved. Mm-hmm. And the Navajo Nation is one of the largest indigenous communities in the United States, with a population of over 175,000 people in Arizona alone that live on the reservation. So when you think about that, you have so many Navajo people living within the Navajo Nation that still don't have access to water. According to Boone Igren, they said that at least more than 30% of the people in homes on the Navajo Nation don't have access to sustainable water sources, right, which includes indoor plumbing and just access to running water. So they still have to live by hauling water on a daily basis.
Yeah. So, I mean, this makes a huge difference for tens of thousands of people, it sounds like. The next step here, it sounds like, and when we talk about water infrastructure and funding for that going forward, is building that, like getting piped water to homes for the first time.
Yeah, the settlement will allow for reliable and safe water sources for these communities. And I think one of the interesting things that is a part of the settlement is that it is looking for help to build those water infrastructures within these communities, because they want to be able to make sure that the people who are living on their tribal land and people a part of the Hopi Nation, the San Juan Paiute Nation, and the Navajo Nation have something to rely on in the future, because everyone is trying to make sure they have water that can sustain their own communities.
Yeah. So how are tribes reacting to this deal? Are they happy with the results of these years of negotiations?
Yeah, so the Navajo Nation, the San Juan Paiute Tribe, and the Hopi Tribe all have commended this legislation and this water settlement. The tribal councils of each of the tribes passed the original a settlement within their own communities this past May. So this legislation being introduced to Congress is on the federal level. So they're really appreciative for all of the help and the resources that everyone has been able to provide them to get them to this point.
Yeah. And for the San Juan Paiute tribe, this is an even bigger deal, right? Like, this is also creating their reservation boundaries.
Yeah, which I thought was a really unique part of the settlement. Like, as part of the settlement, the tribe will gain 54,000 acres of land within the Navajo Nation, which will be proclaimed as the San Juan Southern Paiute Reservation, and the land will be held in trust by the United States if this gets passed. And this would be the first time that the San Juan Paiute would have their own tribal boundaries. So I think that is such an amazing opportunity for them, and something I feel like they have waited for a long time.
Yeah. So, lastly, then, what are the odds of this in Congress? Can we expect this legislation to pass through both houses here? It's been introduced bipartisan, coalitions in both houses. What's the political game?
So, from a lot of discussions that the tribal leaders have had, is that they're hopeful and they feel like now was the best time to introduce it. But there's always challenges, especially because it's not a cheap price tag on this settlement. It's nearly $5 billion, so that might cause some pushback, but I think everyone is really hopeful, and they have the bipartisan support behind it. You had six people from Arizona come together to back this legislation.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. We'll watch for what happens next. Shondeen Silversmith with the Arizona Mirror joining us. Shondeen, thanks for coming on. As always, appreciate it.
Of course, thank you for having me.
2024 is the first time in decades that the Republican Party platform does not call for a national ban on abortion. But our next guest says it also points toward establishing fetal personhood through the 14th Amendment. It's just one example of how the GOP and abortion opponents are reshaping their message around abortion in a post-Roe world in which it's become clear that most Americans support some abortion rights, and many Republican candidates have backed away from the issue. I spoke more about their new strategies in this political landscape with the 19th's Shefali Luthra. She covers reproductive rights for the outlet and is the author of the new book, Undue Burden: Life and Death in a Post-Roe America.
Abortion opponents are in a pretty tough spot. They just came off a Supreme Court year in which they didn't succeed. They were trying to get mifepristone, an abortion pill, restricted, and they lost. And that's really been a setback for them because what they're advocating for is not popular. They are finding that lawmakers are a bit more nervous now about passing new restrictions on abortion, especially in states where there are already bans in place, because they don't want to risk the political blowback. And they also have seen what we've all seen for the past 2 years, which is that whenever voters have a chance to vote on abortion rights, abortion has won. And so they're trying to find a new way around that. They are focusing a lot on what they say is late-term abortion, which is a medically meaningless term, but it serves to demonize abortion and make people think it's something much more extreme. And what they are really focusing on is trying to muddy the waters a bit when it comes to how we talk about abortion, especially when it's on the ballot. And there was reporting out of Arizona that showed that they were trying to get ballot language on a proposed ballot measure there to call fetuses unborn human beings. They've put out ads in Florida where abortion is also on the ballot, saying that this measure would be very extreme, that no one knows what viability is, which is the point to which it would guarantee the right to an abortion, even though viability is pretty well established. And they're trying to suggest that it would create an abortion wild west. And that's really what they see as their best hope of winning, because the public doesn't approve of very extreme abortion bans. They largely don't think abortion should be available in all cases, but they are more supportive of it than not. And so if you oppose abortion, your best and only hope really is to cast Democrats and abortion rights supporters, who often go hand in hand, as quite radical.
So there's a lot to unpack there. Let's return to Arizona for a moment. And there are kind of parallel conversations happening in other parts of the country, like Florida, that you mentioned. We're talking about lawmakers here using the phrase unborn human being instead of fetus and the citizens initiative that would enshrine abortion rights into the state constitution. That's now headed to court. Talk a little bit about the language here and how, whether or not you're talking about what counts as extreme or the other phrase that you used here, late-term abortion. There seems to be a lot that comes into the semantics right now in terms of how the politics are playing around this.
Exactly. And in the Arizona case, they want it to be called an unborn human being for any pregnancy past 15 weeks. And that's a line that abortion opponents have been trying to shift the debate toward. They have been trying to call that the era of when late-term abortions begin, even though just a few years ago, they were saying 20 weeks. And a few years before that, they were saying 22. Mm-hmm. And I have spoken to a lot of pollsters about this, including strategists who work in largely Republican and anti-abortion settings, and they've been quite clear about this. There is no scientific justification for saying that 15 weeks onward is when this becomes a quote-unquote late-term abortion or an unborn human being in a way that it wasn't before 15 mm-hmm. weeks. What it actually is a reflection of the polling. And that is the earliest number that they can find where they have more Republican support than not. And I even had someone say to me once, it's 15 because it's a nice number. It's round. People love fives and zeros.
So, I mean, it's shifted a lot, as you mentioned, over the decades, right, in terms of what abortion opponents are actually pushing for, a 6-week ban, a total ban, an 8-week ban, a 15-week ban, right? And the Republican Party recently adopted a platform that was different again, right?
Exactly. And this has gotten quite a lot of attention in the press, but it's pretty complicated. And the headline for a lot of folks was that this was the first time in decades that the Republican Party platform does not call for a national 20-week abortion ban. And there was a quick movement to say, oh, well, that's a tremendous loss for the anti-abortion movement. But I think it's important that we look a bit deeper at what the platform says. It's pretty bare bones, but it does underscore the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And it suggests that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, the Equal Protection Amendment passed during Reconstruction after the Civil War, protects fetuses. It protects embryos. Mm-hmm. And that is a tenet of the anti-abortion movement's fetal personhood goal. The platform that the RNC adopted says that the 14th Amendment can be used to justify state abortion bans. They're trying to have it both ways, not the 14th Amendment, but also say this is a state's issue. But in reality, by nodding at this particular federal provision, it does begin to lay a legal framework, ideology, political argument that there should be a national abortion ban and that it is seated in the Constitution. And that is the argument that anti-abortion activists are really, really trying to make. And they are quite thrilled that this is something that has been included in the RNC platform.
Hmm. What's next on the mifepristone front, right? Like abortion opponents are working to stop people in other ways from getting abortion pills in the mail still. Is that right?
They absolutely are. It is an existential concern for them because what they have seen is people who are in states with abortion bans can still access abortion by getting mifepristone and misoprostol mailed to them.
Right.
They lost at the Supreme Court. They are trying to bring that case back because that case was dismissed on a technicality, the question of whether the plaintiffs had legal standing to sue.
Right.
Idaho, Kansas, and Missouri, the attorneys general there have said that they would like to join the suit. And it seems that the courts are open to that. So in all likelihood, we will see this case return to the Supreme Court in the coming years. What I have also heard from abortion opponents is they are really leaning on the election and on the presidential election. They are hoping that by having an administration in the White House that is friendlier to their cause, that is at the very least staffed by abortion opponents, they could see the DOJ and the FDA and other such federal agencies be used to crack down on the mailing of abortion pills, to find ways to restrict access to mifepristone. And that for them would be a tremendous victory with consequences not only in states where abortion is banned, but across the country.
But on that front, like even if former President Trump wins the White House, this has shifted tremendously. His position on abortion has shifted tremendously. Is there a lot of hope from abortion opponents that an administration like that would carry out their wishes?
the abortion opponents feel pretty confident that they will be able to continue exerting pressure on a Trump administration, in part because of the people who have advised him in the past and because of his record on this issue when he was in the White House and the people they anticipate filling administrative positions. President Trump's administration didn't just nominate Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. It also did exert policies that were anti-abortion. They changed the federal Title X program so that it wouldn't fund Planned Parenthood. There's a real world in which they can have the allies they need in the White House and in surrounding agencies, even if the president himself doesn't want to vocally commit to any of these things.
All right. Lots to watch for there. Shefali Luthra, reproductive health reporter for The 19th and author of the new book, Undue Burden, Life and Death in Post-Roe America, joining us to talk more about the political landscape here. Shefali, thank you for coming back on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a local songwriter on why her guitar teacher took her to play in pubs when she was just 12 years old.
He's a crazy old dude. He's a cancer like me. He was kind of hard on me, but in like a loving way. And he taught me so much.
All that and more in the latest edition of our Tiny Desert Concert Series. But first, some theater or concert goers or sports fans have, over the years, saved their ticket stubs from the shows or games they've attended. But that's not much of a thing anymore. Not because those attendees have lost their interest in their collections, but because paper tickets don't really exist for many of these events. It's a topic that hits close to home for Bailey Sincox. She's a Perkins Coie postdoctoral fellow at Princeton University and a lecturer in the school's English department. In an essay, she traces the demise of the paper ticket and considers what's lost when entry to events is almost entirely digital. Sincox spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with what got her interested in this transformation of ticket stubs, programs, and memorabilia from events from paper to more digital.
Well, first, let me say that I've always been a theater kid. Not that I had lots of opportunities to see professional theater when I was growing up, but I was involved in theater at school. And when I went to college, I did a summer program where we went to London and we saw a play essentially every day for 6 weeks.
Wow.
And for me, who had never seen much professional theater before, this was mind-blowing. It was absolutely phenomenal. And I saved all of those tickets and made a collage that I had in my dorm room and then in my apartment for ages. And something that I was reflecting on this year, as I'm now a professor, I now teach English, I teach Shakespeare, and I took a group of students to London on a study abroad trip, much like that one I went on more than 10 years ago, was how much things have changed. Because I took them to see not 32 shows, but a couple of shows, and there was no paper trail, right? The way that we got into these theaters was I scanned a QR code on my phone, in most cases, for all of us. The way that we enter the theater, the way that that experience feels, and also the souvenirs, the traces that you have to take home have really transformed between that moment when I first discovered theater and now.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, if you go to a concert or a sporting event or, you know, a theatrical performance, you almost never, unless you print it out at home on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, you almost never have a physical ticket. And in some cases, you don't even get a physical program anymore.
It's so true. In fact, now, so I live in New Jersey, I'm close enough to take the train into New York anytime I want to see a Broadway show. The main way I get tickets is through an app called TodayTix. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to call the box office. They don't have to mail me tickets in a little envelope, or I don't have to pick up the tickets at will call. Everything happens in my phone. The tickets live inside that little screen.
I would think in some ways it's probably a good thing, right? Like you don't have to worry about when you leave the house, do I have my tickets? Or worry if they're mailing you tickets, will they get lost in the mail? Will they get there in time? Anything like that. Most people aren't going to forget their phone anyway, but especially if they know their ticket is on it.
True. I don't mean to make it sound like this is a complete loss, this change. Absolutely not. It's way more convenient, right? You don't have the situation where you've planned your family trip to Manhattan and you fly into New York and you get to the city, you get to the hotel and you realize mom left the tickets to Lion King at home or something like that.
Right, right? Yeah.
That doesn't happen. Though unexpected events can make it difficult to access your tickets if your phone dies.
So I am somebody who, when I was a kid, would save ticket stubs to, you know, baseball games or hockey games or concerts or things like that. And now, you know, my kids are in shows and, you know, I'd like to save tickets from all that stuff. And I can't. And for me, it's sort of a sentimental kind of thing. Like, I like going back and, you know, if you look at the ticket stub, you know, I can remember sort of the events that surrounded that particular event that I had the ticket for, whereas now you really can't. I wonder if sort of as a society or maybe even just historically, are we losing something by not having the physical tickets and in some cases the physical programs to these events that we attend?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about tickets, as with any other souvenir or memento, is that they participated in this event with you. The tickets were there, and they're a record of the fact that you were there. And so I think emotions naturally attach to these objects because they carry those traces. They spur our memories.
Is there anything historically that's lost when we don't have the physical tickets to some of these events?
I love this question because part of my scholarly activity is researching and writing about the theater of the 16th and 17th centuries, at the time in which Shakespeare was writing and performing plays in London. And there are relatively few traces of the theater of that time that survive. And in later periods, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, we begin to have these larger paper trails, these larger collections of artifacts that survive. And many of them survive because people, everyday people who went to the theater, saved them. Because people who had these emotional attachments, who wanted to remember their experiences, the shows they saw, kept playbills, programs, tickets, once tickets became common in theaters in the Anglophone world. And they can teach us a lot about what it was like to live at that time, to make art at that time, to participate in the world of theater or any other trade.
Do you think that this transition was inevitable?
I think so. I think it was already very much in progress, but COVID accelerated it in a big way.
Do you think that will change? Do you think that concerts and sporting events and theaters at some point will go back to paper tickets, or at least an option for paper tickets?
Honestly, I don't see that becoming a reality. I think if anything, we're going to move away from tickets requiring contact between patrons and staff in any way.
Like you just scan your phone on a machine to get in.
Or even, I mean, I don't actually know that much about what technology is in the works for these sorts of things. I'm a Shakespeare professor, but I can foresee a world in which you gain access to a football stadium or a theater through geolocation technology that's linked to your smart device in the same way that we have these cashierless checkouts in some stores now. Right. Or even, who knows, even facial recognition technology like we're seeing at airports.
Yeah. So just out of curiosity, do you still by chance look at that collage you made back when you were in college?
You know, I do. It had kind of become faded by the sun. I eventually took it down, but I discovered it when I moved to Princeton actually a few years ago. And I thought, oh, it's, you know, it really brought back those memories in part because the tickets are all different. They all have their own personality, which is to say they're branded. They have the name of the theater. They have a logo. They're also different sizes. So they all had their own quirks. They all were unique in a way that recalled what it was like to go to that theater, see that show at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Bailey, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bailey Sincox is a Perkins Coxon postdoctoral fellow at Princeton University and a lecturer in the English department there.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Those who lived in Tucson back in the day may remember their local Chinese grocer. But how did Chinese and Mexican families in Tucson create a blended border town? As the show's Athena Ankra reports, an oral historian working with the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center has been collecting stories from the descendants of the first Chinese families who found a home in Tucson.
928 North Anita Street is called Barrio Anita. So we learned how to speak Spanish before we could speak English.
That's Mary Lo Wong. She's Chinese, she's Mexican, she's American, she's a Tucsonense. Her family has been in South Tucson since the 1880s. Here she describes the bonds between the Chinese and Mexican communities when she was growing up.
We knew everybody, and I remember across the street, the Reese family taught us how to cook Mexican food, and we were almost like family. We were back and forth in their house, and they were in our house, so we would eat in their house, and they would eat in our house.
Wong is one of many descendants of Tucson's first Chinese families that carved out a unique space in the Sonoran borderlands amid economic and social pressure to keep them out. Now, her family story joins a collection of oral histories gathered in 2017 by the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center's scholar-in-residence, Dr. Priscilla Martinez. The project, called Tucson Speaks, Finding Place, Finding Home, is aimed at preserving the histories of Chinese Tucsonans, but also gives them the tools to chronicle their own history, even after Martinez goes back to her home state of Texas.
Stories tell us about who we are, how we navigate the world around us, especially for communities that don't have, or archives who did not view these communities' history as valuable. And so oral history is a way to get at that.
Here's another resident, Raymond Lim, and his daughter Dana, sharing their love of his Chinese-American mom's Mexican cooking.
We used to have green corn tamales. Boy, that was really good.
She would make both kinds of tamales, oh, yeah. Red chili tamales and green corn tamales.
Menudo.
And her and her sisters.
Wow.
Her and her sisters would all get together, and they would have tamale making days, and the kids would come and help, and it was a big family affair. And
their family has been in the area since the mid-19th century. His grandmother, Lai Nan, was a Chinese business owner who eventually settled with her children in Tucson after moving through border towns in California, Sonora, and Arizona. Constant movement was not uncommon for these families at the time. Racist and exclusionary policies pushed Chinese Americans from place to place, often following work on the railroads. Take it from longtime resident Anna Dawn Belton.
From 1928 to 1940, we had lived in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 cities.
But Tucson was different. Consider the story of Mary Lee Malaby, for instance. Her grandfather was a wealthy Mexican landowner named Jesus Valencia, the namesake of Valencia Road in South Tucson. So the story goes, Valencia hired a Chinese clerk named Lee Goon to run his grocery store. Lee Goon brought his teenage son Lee Hop to the States to help out, and in 1933, Lee Hop and Valencia's granddaughter Maria Trujillo formed a romantic relationship. But because of anti-miscegenation laws in Arizona, the two couldn't get married. Despite this, they had a domestic partnership and 9 children. That would be Mary Lee and her siblings. And for nearly a decade, the family lived behind a new grocery store that they opened on their own in Barrio Ochoa. Official records don't show that.
If you look at census records, you'll see that he lived alone and Maria Trujillo lived with her mother at the time. And they had separate addresses. But if you look at the oral history, they say, no, we lived together behind the grocery store, and we were a family together.
Ultimately, social pressures and legal complications forced the two apart, and the laws prohibiting their marriage persisted even into the years their eldest daughters were ready to get married.
Both of us got married in Mexico, but I said,
maybe it's not legal because it's New Mexico. That's Mexico. So we got married again in New Mexico. He got married twice, George, and I got married twice.
So Arizona had a law that said that you could not get married.
Because we're Chinese.
Because you're Chinese. And your husband, George, wasn't Chinese.
No, he's Mexican. And my sister's was Anglo. And she got married over there, too, in Mexico.
So you went
George and Mary Lee got married again in Tucson on New Year's Day in 1960, 7 years before the Supreme Court ruled anti-miscegenation laws unconstitutional. Martinez says stories like these defy typical narratives of border communities.
When we think about the borderlands and the militarization of the border, today we have these very black and white images of who belongs and who doesn't. But for anyone who's lived in the borderlands, that is rarely the case. These state restrictions factor into people's lives and their choices that they make as individuals and as families and members of communities, but they don't define them.
Tucson Speaks started back in 2017, but the pandemic put the project on pause until now. 4 of the 9 original participants have since passed away. Robin Blackwood is the chair of the Tucson Chinese Cultural Center's History Committee. She says that as the community loses elders who remember Tucson in the early days, the need to give them the tools to record their own histories grows more urgent.
Oh, yeah. Red chili tamales and green corn tamales.
Menudo.
And her sisters.
Wow.
Her and her sisters would all get together and they would have tamale making days and the kids would come and help. And it was a big family affair. And I actually am trying to pass that tradition on to the next generation.
Yeah, Dana makes the tamales.
I'm the only one in the family now that makes tamales and menudo because I learned from my grandmother, but it's a dying tradition.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
Raymond Lim has since passed away, but his daughter Dana still makes those green corn and red chile tamales from the old family recipe. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra. China, dulce amor del alma mía. More and more indigenous chefs have been opening restaurants in recent years, introducing their food traditions to non-native diners. Andy Murphy has been tracking the indigenous food sovereignty movement for several years. That refers to, among other things, an indigenous community's ability to deal with issues of health and hunger by cultivating their own healthy food and controlling how that food is produced and distributed. Murphy is the creator, host, and producer of the Toasted Sister podcast. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody in March about the impetus for the podcast and the kind of need she was trying to fill.
Well, I had always been really interested in food. I just really noticed that there was a lot happening in the Native food world, like this whole Native American food movement, this indigenous food movement was really starting to, you know, be really active. So I just felt that there was a whole lot of room for, you know, more food stories out there.
Yeah. Well, so what kinds of changes and evolutions have you seen in the Native American food scene since you started doing this, you know, those years ago?
Oh, man. Well, I started the podcast back in 2017. And since then, we've really seen so much. Not only are there a lot more Native food segments in television and live TV, there's a lot more coverage of Indigenous food and food issues in food media. There's a couple of different chefs have really made a name for themselves in the last couple of years, like, you know, Sean Sherman and Crystal Wapipa. They've really come out of the woodwork and really shown everybody like how important this work is and how you know, the whole community, the whole Native food community is behind them and really doing a lot of the similar work. And these days, currently, I think the entrepreneurship side of Indigenous food is really seeing a boom.
Does that mean that more and more people, especially more and more non-Native people, are now eating Native food?
Well, I think so. I think they are really getting hungry for it. And, you know, and that creates a good market for these businesses. Some of them, some of these restaurants are, you know, kind of high end. They, you know, they fill that that niche, I guess, in the community. And, you know, a lot of these other businesses, too, they just make available a lot of local produce and food products that might come from the tribe in the state. And I think everybody is really interested in local food. That's what is really driving, you know, all of this interest. And it's also from the Native community, too. We're also getting educated about Indigenous food and becoming aware of the food products and businesses that are coming from our tribes, tribes in the States, and tribes all across the country.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I'm wondering from the chef, from the restaurateur perspective, like how much are they sort of learning about all of this along with the people who are coming to the restaurants?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. They have to. It's the chefs who are really kind of at the front line of, you know, driving that interest for local food. They just, I think, automatically know who's doing the farming and who is doing the ranching and the meat processing in their area. I mean, it really makes a lot better menu, a lot better plate for people. And they really have to be knowledgeable about what's around them.
Well, I'm curious what you hear from chefs about sort of the balance of keeping the tradition of, you know, maybe what their community is known for food wise, or maybe what their family, you know, family members had cooked. But at the same time, sort of on the chef side, on the creative side, pushing forward and trying to be creative and inventive and maybe come up with something of their own.
Yeah, there is definitely that kind of balance I see with chefs who are actively out there. They have these different, like, you know, chef hats or different roles that they fill sometimes. Sometimes they can be really true to their, say, Navajo, since I'm Navajo, really true to traditional Navajo dishes and ingredients. And they can, you know, be a teacher, a culinary teacher in that aspect and share that kind of knowledge within the community. And then on the other side, they can really show all the flavors of Indigenous America. They can be mixing blue corn with the bison and the tortillas and maple syrup and wild rice and salmon all in one dinner to showcase what Native America tastes like and what foods are available and out there from tribal food businesses and individual food businesses. So I see that kind of balance a lot among Indigenous chefs.
What are you hearing about what might be in store in 2024? Like, are there any trends that are starting to emerge or that might be strengthened that have been coming up over the last number of years?
I think we might be seeing maybe one or two more years of just more business, more food business. And I really want to see maybe a chef or a food company come up with their own line of like kitchen utensils or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's kind of like the next step for any food empire is to come up with an awesome restaurant and then, come up with a chain and a concept that kind of goes across the country, and then, your own products of aprons or, kind of like a pioneer woman. But I really hope that the movement kind of comes down here, and we hear a lot about stuff happening in the Midwest, in Minneapolis, I think, because just because the sous chef is there and Sean Sherman is there, doing a lot of good work. I think I want to hear more from the Southwest from here, and I'm really trying to, gather folks in this area and trying to make some noise in the future. So hopefully in the future we'll see a lot more happening in the Southwest.
That is Andy Murphy, creator, host, and producer of the Toasted Sister podcast. Andy, really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. And now it's time for our next Tiny Desert concert. Morphia Slow started as Aline Dugan's solo project, but now it's a full-on band. The 23-year-old songwriter calls her music murder folk pop, and her unique introduction to guitar contributes to Morphia Slow's unique sound. We sat down together to talk more about it in a rather odd place for a young musician, at American Legion Post 138, an old veterans hall in Tempe. The bar is decked out with lots of American flags and military paraphernalia. I started by asking Dugan to tell me more about how she was, as she says, groomed to be a musician.
I've just been playing music forever, and I think it was because there was a want to just like kind of have me do something that my parents couldn't do. And for a while that was kind of, it was just something I did, but I think now I'm realizing that it is important and it is something I've turned out to be really good at.
But when you say you started playing music at a very young age, like this wasn't just piano and guitar lessons, like you were playing in bars, right?
Oh yeah. So let me talk about that. So that was a little later. That was when I was like 11, 12 years old. My mom worked at Maricopa Elementary School, and she had a paraprofessional named Jeannie Jones, and they became friends. And my mom was mentioning that I wanted to learn guitar, which I did. And Jeannie said, "Well, my husband is a lifelong musician, and he's never taught anyone before, but maybe he would want to teach her." So me and Trevor Jones, we are best friends. He calls me his best friend. He's a crazy old dude. He's a Cancer like me. We just have a very loving and really unique relationship. We're kindred spirits for sure. He was kind of hard on me, but in like a loving way. And he taught me so much. And he would take me out with him to his gigs, and he would play at different pubs all over the valley. And let me tell you, I've sang Bobby McGee about 1,000 times.
So an interesting kind of upbringing in music. Does that, and does your, early guitar teacher have anything to do with why we are here at a veterans memorial hall today playing?
As a matter of fact, it does. He's been playing here for I don't even know how long, years and years. And he would have me come in. And at first, I didn't really love it. Like, I was like 13, 14 years old. But as I got older, and maybe when I started being able to drink, I really loved coming in here. And the people here have become like sort of my family. And I would come in here like every Sunday. And I've kind of called it lately like a pseudo church in a way. Like it's a routine.
Tell me about the name, Morphia Slow.
A lot of artists do a stage name, and I always loved Rocky Horror Picture Show as a kid. Like, funny story, I accidentally watched the Rocky Horror Picture Show at like 4 years old.
Too young, yeah.
Too young to watch it, but I don't know. My mom thought I was asleep. This is the story. My mom thought I was asleep, and she's watching it on the couch, just like chilling. She's having her me time or whatever. And I'm apparently in the background. And then the next day or so, we go to my like Mormon grandparents' house, and I'm singing. I'm just a sweet transvestite. I said transvestite. Anyway, the name Morpheus Lowe, it's kind of a misheard lyric from Over at the Frankenstein Place when Riff Raff is up in the window and he goes, "The darkness must flow down the river of light streaming. Flow, Morpheus, slow, let the sun."
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah, okay.
So that's where it came from, and I always thought that was interesting, and no one else had really used that name. And I put it as my Instagram handle, and I just started using it, and then it became the band.
Talk a little bit about musical inspiration. Genre is always an interesting question. I know I hear certain things when I hear your music, but I'm sure you think about it differently. How would you describe the genre you fit into?
If I was to broadly describe it, I would say folk rock. In the era of when I was writing most of these songs that are on this album, I was really listening to a lot of Big Thief. I feel like that's the main. I think so many people just look up to Big Thief so much, so I would definitely credit them as an inspiration for sure. But I think I can't discredit the influences of just like old folk classics. Like, I love Lead Belly. I love Bob Dylan. You know, just all the classic stuff that I've learned over the years that I think informs my playing and informs how I come to write lyrics.
So how do you write a song? Does it start with lyrics for you? Does it start with a poem? Does it start with a melody in your head?
I think all songs are different methods for sure. But for example, Murder Ballad, I was really sad. I was like, it was like 2020, and I was like on Tinder or something. I wrote this long poem, and all of the rest of it was kind of incomprehensible drivel. But one part said, "We die for love, die for money and fame," which is the refrain of Murder Ballad. So that really stuck with me, and then I somehow came up with the rest of that. And it's funny to look back on songs that you've written, because I always say I could never write that song again.
And we'll hear that one now.
This is Murder Ballad number 25.
Shows. We die for love, die for money and fame. You cut off your thumb for a kiss in the rain. It only goes to show that your mother was a stranger and your father was a whore. Just a shadow in the mirror in the hall. Leave me alone, don't you know I'm in pain? I'm never gonna see the sunrise again. I know who told you before that a kiss for every mistress leaves you and her child ignored.
Feel like it's an emotional outlet for you? Like, are you not a super open book otherwise?
I'd say I'm an open book. But it's definitely an emotional outlet. I find the best time to write a song is when you feel the worst, because it just lets you let it out. And once you can let it out on the page and let it out into recording, you can, in a way, release it to other people to decipher.
That makes sense. All right, so you're going to take us out on a song here. What's it called?
Well, Midday Landslide, I remember I wrote it sitting under a tree in my complex. And it's kind of about alcoholism and hope for the future. I remember when I was a child, I one time went over to my uncle's house and he was drinking a drink, and I thought it was a White Russian because I was a Big Lebowski fan, but it was a landslide, and that always stuck with me. So the concept of, it's kind of about getting older and coming to terms with who you are, and you kind of have to live every day. Like, you have to be present every day or else you're dead, basically. So it's about coming to terms with what you can be and, like, really seizing the moment. And I think it's just a reminder to myself and hopefully to others too.
It'll all be better someday.
Aline Dugan of Morphia Slow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It'll all be better someday. Mother's out and father's sleeping, so why in the hell are you weeping? You got something to show, so of dreaming when you're not sleeping it all away. You'll be better someday. You'll be better someday. Take some time.
You can hear more songs from Morphia Slow's Tiny Desert Concert and see the video of their performance on our website. That's theshow.kjzz.org. And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of The Show. Be sure to join us tomorrow with much more. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
You know.